loves a class that begins with a quiz. We're going to have a little bit of quiz by way of review this morning. If you were here early, you saw the answers. I advanced the animation too far, so all the answers were up there. But if you just came in, you're going to have to figure it out for yourself. Before we answer the questions, if you're here visiting, really happy you're here. I always see faces I don't recognize. Glad you're here. Even if you're not visiting, we're glad you're here, participating in the class. Our third class, as we study through 1 Peter, 2 Peter, and hopefully Jude. Thank you to Larry for filling in on Wednesday night. I'm back, and you've got me for the next couple class periods. I know we didn't get all the way through verse 12 on Wednesday. I heard rumors that we made a good attempt at it, but we're going to cover what we didn't cover on Wednesday today and hopefully get all the way down through verse 10 of chapter 2 this morning. All right, so what are our answers? And I will give you a hint. Most of these are found very early in the first chapter. We talked about them last Sunday morning. What were these people, this group of people, addressed or called, identified as? Not the city names, so there were cities that were, or in regions that were called out, but what did Peter refer to them as? Pilgrims, elect. Melissa, did you say something different? God's elect. Aliens, good. But another one, somebody who's on a trip that doesn't really belong there. Sojourners, there's a kind of the ones there. Pilgrims, aliens, you guys got them. Thank you. Again, so this is really referring to us as well as we think about our walk as a Christian. Think about the things that Peter might have to say to us here in Atlanta, Georgia, in January of 2020. We fit in this group and category. Okay, two things, or at least two things, that would be true if there is no resurrection. So there's not a lot of this in the first chapter, but it does talk about the importance of Christ's resurrection and the great blessings and benefits that we have from that. What are some things, maybe from this text and other texts as well, that are true if there is no resurrection from the dead? If Christ wasn't resurrected, if we have no resurrection, what's true? There's no hope. Yeah, take hope and throw it out the window. What else? Yeah, everything you're doing is for naught. What about what Peter's telling them and what other apostles have told them before? It's really wrong and it's all lies and it's really not worth listening to, right? So I think I got all those there. False witnesses by all of this testimony if it's not based on the blood of Christ and his resurrection. I think it's very important that Peter gets to that very early here. The foundation and the authority for all of this and the great hope we have is based on the fact that Christ did arise and that we will meet him again one day. All right, four reasons why we should have hope. Or you can have more than four if you want. Yes, sir, Ebenezer. Excuse me? Salvation, yes. Good. The resurrection should give us hope. That is it. That's the foundation of it. Others? Absolutely. We've got this great inheritance, and he calls that out specifically here in the first chapter. I think you guys got most of them. Jesus is alive. God is merciful. That's another really, really important one as well. You mentioned our inheritance and that we are guarded. It's something that's held. It's firm. It's not fleeting. It's not going to go away. It's on a firm foundation. I didn't mention it, but there are lessons in the back on the table. I think Doug was handing them out here in class as well. I appreciate you doing that. And Bill's got some more in the back. If you don't have a lesson for today's class, raise your hand and Bill will get you one. We're on lesson 3. We'll pick up lesson 4, obviously, on Wednesday night. This is a big transitional passage that we're going to cover today. So as we think about the things that we talked about on Wednesday night, Peter talked about this great, wonderful blessing that we've got through God's grace of salvation. Now we get into a transitional period around verse 13 where Peter basically says, okay, we've got this great blessing. Now what are we going to do with it? What is the products of salvation? And he's going to continue through chapter 2 and talk about how we should live. So kind of the practical application here of what it means now that Christ has done these great things for us. So that's kind of the flow of things. All right, before we get into it, I've asked Dwight to lead our minds in prayer, and then we'll get started. Amen. So I said I was going to review a little bit of verses 1 through 12 and cover the things that we didn't get to on Wednesday, and this is the way I'm going to do it. I've got a slide, and I will admit from the onset here that it is a complicated slide. So please try and follow with me along through it. I haven't used a slide in a few years, and I had to look at it a couple times to figure out what it meant, and I created most of it. So anyway, let me explain it to you. This is a timeline, a chronology of events related to the gospel, right? All the way from Old Testament, the beginnings, or even before the beginnings of the earth, all the way through present day when Peter wrote to them. And it's all out of the first chapter of 1 Peter. So it's not sequential. It's not going to be verse 1, 2, 3, 4. It's going to put the things that Peter talks about in sequential order. Basically, the whole story of Christ and the gospel here in the first 12 verses. And then we're going to step back and make some observations about the things that happened to Christ and the things that are happening to these people and the things that will happen to us as well. So if we kind of go back to the beginning, again, the beginning of time here, Peter calls out very clearly here in verse 10 and 11, this whole story of the gospel, this whole coming of Christ is something that has been talked about for a very, very long time, prophesied about for a very, very long time. So people were hopefully expecting Christ, expecting the Messiah. So this was something that was predicted a very, very long time ago. And then in verse 20, Christ was manifest. Christ came, and these folks had the benefit of knowing the story of the gospel and what Christ did. But it says in verse 11 that Christ suffered. But that suffering, we know that suffering was on the cross, that suffering transitioned over into glory, right? He was glorified with God, raised back up with God. So that kind of happens there in verse 11. Now, these folks and others in verse 12 and other verses here in the first chapter had heard about this great story of the gospel. They had had apostles visit them. They'd had inspired writers write these things to them. So they were given this information to change and make a change in their life. And many of them, certainly the ones that were Christians, did this in verse 23. They were born again. They had a new beginning from the power of this word, from the power of Christ's message. Now, I ran out of slide here, so we're going to kind of continue this theme of a timeline left to right here. They were begotten again. Now, so this is speaking to the people and the Christians that he's writing to specifically and speaking to us as well, that now for a little while there are some things that are happening to us in our lives and in their lives. So if you see verse 6, 3, 5, all these, I'm not going to read all the passages there, but we have a living hope. And as we mentioned earlier in the quiz, that hope is guarded, it is secure, there's a foundation. But there's also this periods of suffering and trials that are going to come. And we see that in verse 6, and we'll see that certainly later in the letter as well, that there's a lot of challenge and trials. There's some instructions about how we're supposed to be loving and behaving in Jesus in verse 8 and others. And there's a period of joy here as well. But there are more things coming as well. He speaks about the revelation of Christ. Christ is coming back, verse 7. And at that period, when he comes back, in these last times, we're going to have the benefit of all these great things that we've been told about if we live the right way as Christians. So this inheritance that's been promised, all these things are going to come true at the end. Well, it was kind of interesting to me, and that's kind of the end of the timeline there. But if you look at this and compare the top section where it talks primarily about the story of Jesus, he had this period of suffering, and these Christians are going to have this period of suffering as well. But there's also this period of glory and getting the reward of the inheritance that is to come as well. So I think that's very, very interesting here, encouraging, uplifting to me and hopefully the people that heard this, is there is a period of time and difficulty that they're going to suffer in really big ways under persecution, but these things that are promised to them through Christ are coming. So again, I promised it was pretty complicated, but that is kind of the first 12 verses put in a chronology in line with the story of the Bible. Hopefully that is helpful. Anybody have any comments or questions on that other than you don't understand it? Okay. All right. Hopefully people got that. Now we're going to jump right into the material, and I'm going to get on track here. So I know you guys didn't really cover verse 10, 11, and 12 in the class on Wednesday, so I'm going to read these verses, and we're going to make a couple comments, and I'm going to ask you some questions about them before we get into verse 13. So verse 10 of 1 Peter 1. Of this salvation, the prophets have inquired and searched carefully who prophesied of the grace that would come to you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ was to come in them was indicating when he testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. To them it was revealed that not to themselves, but to us they were ministering the things which they have been reported to you through those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things which angels desire to look into. So I want to kind of focus on that last little phrase there in verse 12, things that the angels desire to look into. What does that mean? Anyone have an idea? It's kind of an open question. Why would the angels desire to look into these things? Aren't the angels like on the inside track and kind of know this whole script here? Janice? Okay. All right, so they know everything in God's plan. That's good. I like that. It also says they have a desire to look into these things. It's like a little bit of an urgency there related to this, I pick up from it. Other thoughts on this? Ideas? Look over, if you will, to 2 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 4. And I'm not going to read all of this, but I think it has something to do with what he means here at the end of verse 12. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. For if God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them into pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserve Noah, a teacher of righteousness, with seven other souls he brought from the flood in the world and ungodly. And if he didn't condemn the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly therefore. So if we think about these three kind of stories and events and these groups of people, what God has done for us as Christians and what God has done for these folks that Peter is writing to here is wonderful, but it's also unique when you think about it. All of us have sin in our lives, yet God has offered for us a chance to be back with Him and have a relationship with Him through His Son Jesus. That is a great and wonderful blessing. So you can imagine kind of anyone through the course of human history, especially the angels, wanting to understand how God's plan would play out, but having great interest in this thing. It's a wonderful event. It's a wonderful culmination of God's plan. And we, as Christians, are the benefactors of that great plan that He's got. So not only is it revealed now, these Christians and us are the recipients of God's great plan for us. We're not going to get destruction that we really deserve brought on by our sin. We're going to get God's grace and mercy and now have hope. Comments or questions on that? Hopefully that made sense. I think he says this here to restate what a great benefit this blessing that we have of salvation through Christ is. This is no small thing. We see prophets have looked into this and tried to understand it. We have the angels anxiously waiting on the sidelines, if you will, trying to look in to see what is going to happen. And it's a good story. It's the best possible ending here to what could have happened. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Well said. Yeah, if you read these and don't feel special, you're not reading it correctly. So, Jason, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Like that. Any other comments on this? Okay, so with all that said, it's something that people have inquired about for a very, very long time. It's unique. It's special. It's sacred. We're the chosen people. So now he's going to transition into this period of, okay, so then you should act like, live like, do like, these type things. And that's really where verse 13 begins. I liken the first chapter, and really the first and second chapter, to kind of the pregame talk, if you will, the locker room talk. It's a rough analogy, but I'll follow me through it here. So you're the coach, and your team has made it to the, whatever, state championship or whatever, and you're in the locker room and you're talking about it. What do you talk about? Well, you talk about all the things that happened to get up to that point, right? In the terms of like a team, you would talk about all the sacrifice, all the spring practices, all the, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning drills, all the really hardship. You know, we as Christians, we didn't put in work, right? Christ did this stuff for us, but coach would talk about all the hardships he's had through this season. Coach would talk about all the other people that would like to be out there on the field, have an opportunity to win and be victorious, and here we are as a team. And then he would probably transition into, so based on all that, this is how we're going to go out and play the game. Again, it's a rough analogy. If you think about Peter, he's kind of doing the same thing here. He's telling them this great salvation that they have in their hands, this great opportunity. Everyone else through the whole course of human history has been inquiring about this great salvation, this great blessing through Christ. We have this great assurance, this opportunity. Verse 13, now let's go and live our lives this way. Let's play the game, if you will. Let's engage each other in this way. Let's respect Christ in these ways, and let's do these things in response to where we are. Does he have his hand up over here? Somebody stretching. Okay, so it starts verse 13, therefore, so based on all this, this is how we are going to live and move forward. And really, the rest of today's class and Wednesday's class is all following the therefore. So the first thing that he says here in verse 13, and we could spend the whole class on verse 13. I'm going to try not to, but there's a lot in it. So the first thing that he says here is gird up the loins of your mind. So this, people that used to wear robes would have to pull them up and hike them up, I guess, so that they could do work. In the context of girding up our minds, what is he talking about here? What does this mean? Prepare, so state of preparedness, good. Good. So there's action or activity, just like if you needed to pull your robes up to do some like work. So getting our minds ready. How might we prepare or get our minds ready? Yes, sir, Jack. Good. So come into it with a plan of how your mindset was going to be from the beginning. And you said something there that I think is my first bullet point here. Put out things that would impede. So we want to get the right set state of mind, but there's also a lot of things in our mind that might impede, just like a long robe might impede your ability to work. There are things in our mindset that might impede our ability to focus and stay on mission and stay on task. Other comments, or what are some of these things that might impede us in our lives today? Troubles. Perfect. Troubles, worries, obsessions, problems, right? We can get covered up very, very quickly where most of our mental bandwidth is fixated on worries or obsession with material or physical things. We all have a limited amount of mental bandwidth on what we're focusing on. And if your mind is constantly focused on worries, troubles, or trying to get more stuff, that's going to impede your ability to focus on what you need to focus on and impede your ability to be ready spiritually to serve Christ. We kind of see this also. I think there's mentioned one of the verses there. Removing anything that is not profitable in our attempt to grow in our hope. We can be very hopeful about other things as well. Christ says this in Luke chapter 21. My colors aren't that great there. Luke chapter 21 and verse 34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this world, that the day comes on you unexpectedly. So we see carousing and drunkenness, and we say, okay, yeah, those are bad things. I understand how that can impede me and hold me back spiritually. But how about like cares of the world? Everyone's got cares of the world. I would suggest to you that cares of the world, even if they're good cares of the world, can impede you mentally and be an obstacle for you as well. We really see this also over in the parable of the sower in Luke chapter 8 here. You guys are familiar with it. There's these seeds that fall on the thorns, and those are you who heard and go out and are choked with the cares, riches, and pleasures of life and bring no fruit to maturity. So cares, we are usually associated with bad things. But riches and pleasures, how can those be bad things? In the context of your girding yourself mentally, pulling up your mental state of preparedness, these things can be impediments, can be distractions, and can bog you down from what you need to do as a Christian. So it's not always the drinking and the carousing and the things that we associate with negative. There could be good things or positive things or enjoyable things to us as well that can bog us down and cause us not to have our minds girded in the correct way. I always think about what Paul said over in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12. Talks about all things are lawful for me, but not all things are profitable, right? So there are good things that if they impede our state of preparedness and impede what we need to do as a Christian, they can be just as bad or worse than a bad thing. Okay, comments on that one? Yes, sir. Yeah. very good. So they may doubt on their own. And we're also going to read in the second letter, in second Peter, where we have false teachers come in and try and help them in their doubting. So these things are all fables. Nothing's ever going to happen, right? So to your point, there's this personal doubt or lack of faith or lack of hope on this foundation of Christ. But then later, people are going to come in and say, yeah, you should be worried about it because it's a bunch of bunk and you shouldn't believe any of it. So that's another thing that would be an impediment. Vera. Thank you. Yeah, very good. I love that word, deliberate. So Peter wants these folks and wants us to be very deliberate. This is very action-oriented here when he's telling them to gird up the loins of their mind. He wants them to take action. There's no mention here of how you've been saved, through this grace and this hope, kick back and relax. No, it's you need to do these things, and this is the way you need to live, because trials and persecution are going to come. And even if you don't, in light of this great gift and salvation, this is how a saved believer now lives and should react. Thank you. Very deliberate. All of these are very deliberate. Jack and then Ebenezer. Yes. I love it. I love the hiking trip and the analogy. So if you've got stuff in your backpack that weighs like 30 pounds and you're not going to use on the trip, what's it going to do? It's going to slow you down. It's going to impede you. You take that out. It's good. Ebenezer? Yes. Absolutely. Sure. Very good. I'm going to paraphrase what Ebenezer said for everyone that didn't hear it here. So our lives should be primarily focused on spiritual things. That should be the focus of our life. If we have a life that's compartmentalized with work, pleasure, job, all these different distractions, and our spiritual life is just one kind of silo or one slice of this big pie chart, the other things are going to choke it out. Our life needs to be focused on Christ primarily, and those things supporting that. I think that's what you said. All right, we're going to keep moving. He tells them to be sober. There's a classic definition of being sober, but I'm going to expand it a little bit. We need to have self-control. We need to be calm and serious about the matter that we're going into here. We need to be not weak-minded. We need to be strong-minded. These things are all things that we need to help us be focused. Again, back to the pregame locker room talk here. One of the things the team is going to be told by the coaches, focus on the plan. Don't worry about the crowds, the noise, the other team, the distractions. Be focused. Stay on your game plan. Be sober-minded. Don't be weak-minded. Don't let your attention be distracted by different things that are not part of our plan to be successful and do the things that we need to do. So again here, Jesus says, again, something great about everything, but this follows what he says over here in Luke chapter 21, verse 36. Watch, therefore, pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. So there are so many things that are going to come that could distract us, that could cause us to lose focus and cause us to be less sober-minded about the things that we need to do in Christ. All right, we're still in verse 13, but the last part of the class is going to go really, really quickly. I don't know if you can see that very good. So the last part of the verse here, he talks about resting our hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So we have this great grace that God has extended to us through his Son Christ, and we have this great hope sitting on that foundation of God's grace. I would suggest to you that even as Christians sometimes, we don't live this way. We balance our hope kind of on this grace and this plan that God has for us and partially on the world, right? So my friends, my status, my money, my family, I'm dependent on all these different things for my hope. Maybe I'm depending on government. I'm depending on what's going to happen later in life. There's a lot of different things that you can pin your hope to. And kind of the other one that we're often trapped into here is this hope on myself, right? So I'm not really focused on the things that God has done for me and the grace he's extended to me. I'm self-sufficient. I have my own plan, my own pathway. So all the worldly things and plus the things that I can do on my own, that's kind of where my hope really, really is. So we should all examine ourselves and really think about, where does our hope really lie? Are we teeter-tottering? We've got half our hope here on the world and half our hope on the grace that God has given to us, through the plan that he's given to us through his Son. Are we relying on self, or are we having our foundation fully on this cornerstone of grace from God? And it says here in verse 13, rest your hope fully upon the grace. So that's like we're done, right? It's the end of the chapter. We can end class about 15 minutes early. We've got grace, all these great things that Christ has done for us. So it's over, right? No, it's not over. Actually, verse 13 is not really over as well. It continues. So he continues to talk about some other things as well that he wants us to do. So he's already told us to gird up the loins of our mind, to be sober-minded. We've got this great hope rested on this foundation of grace. But then he's going to get talking here in verse 14 about some other things, which is a continuation of verse 13. As obedient children, not conforming yourself to the former lust, as in your ignorance, but he who had called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. So I want to go down through these very quickly. I started the first class by saying Peter mimics and copies the words of Christ pretty predominantly. And if you look through verse 14, it's really true here. These themes that he calls out here, we see all throughout the gospel. So this first theme of obedience. So we've got grace, and we've got our hope is fully rested on grace, but let's don't forget about obedience. Jesus says in John chapter 14 and verse 21, he who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me, and he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. And we see a similar thought over here in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 4. I won't read this one, but again, obedience is important. So Peter is underscoring that again here, just after he talks about the importance of understanding that our hope is foundation is grace. He says here, don't conform yourself to the former lust. What does he mean by this? Don't conform yourself to former lust. That's kind of a little bit hard for us to understand, even in English. What is the implication here? What is he saying? Yeah, there is a before and after someone else. Bill? Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Anyone, whether Jew or Gentile, is basically, don't act like you did before, right? There is a transition here. And I'm not going to have time to read all this, but over here in 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 15, talks about all these former lusts that we had, but now we have this great salvation through Christ. We should put all these things away. And especially, I think, for us, it's important, this passage over in Romans chapter 12, beginning in verse 2, where it talks about, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So when we accept Christ and become a Christian, we could just keep on doing the same things that we did before. We could just keep fitting into the worldly model, conforming to the world that's around us and be a product of the world around us, or we can be transformed and changed. So he's wanting them to be different people than they were before, and he's encouraging that. Part of that is obedience, but part of that also is a condition of the heart and understanding that they need to be changed and they need to be watchful about the things that were in their lives before. This is kind of a difficult one because just becoming a Christian, there's not this magical thing that happens that all your former temptations and problems and lust and whatever issues you had before don't automatically go away. It takes an active role in yourself to try and overcome those things and to be transformed and put those things away. So he's encouraging them to do that. Be obedient. You're going to have things that you want to continue to do that you did before. Don't do those anymore. And then last but not least, to be holy or to be sanctified. And I have a couple verses here that we're not going to get to here that talks about the importance of being holy. So that's kind of how he gives us the complete picture here in verse 14 about what they need to do. We have this great foundation of grace that our hope is resting on. We also need to be obedient. We need to be changed people. We need to aspire to be holy. Now, he brings in this new subject of fear in verses 17, really through 25. Why would we be fearful? He just got done telling us this great plan of salvation, how it's certain, how we have this great hope resting on grace, this great hope that was given to us for no work of our own. Why should we have fear? Why should these folks have fear? Anybody get to that question in the lesson? Yes. Sure. Exactly. Fear has a proper place in our sojourn, in our walk as a Christian. You really see this here through the teachings of Jesus and the teachings of Paul and others as well. And I pulled out two passages here that really quickly kind of demonstrate this point. And over in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 28, do not fear those who kill the body and cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both the soul and body in hell. So there's a judgment there, and that's what you really should be concerned about, not the people that can afflict your body. And then Paul says something very similar over here. We won't read that passage because I'm out of time. So we get to the question of, so fear is a normal part of our walk as a Christian, reasons for the fear. And I got two reasons here out of the first chapter, a little bit of the second. You already mentioned one of them, so I'll just go ahead and put that one up. There is going to be a judgment by the Father. And it's interesting here that the judgment is going to be without partiality. How do you feel about that? Wouldn't that be a good thing, right? If you were going to go to a judge and you were told, here in the city of Atlanta or state of Georgia, and someone said, yeah, I know that judge, he is really impartial, wouldn't you feel good about that? Yeah, I'd feel pretty good about it. In this context, why should an impartial judge make us have fear or be cause for fear? Yeah, 100%. 100%. We know that his judgment is right. Well, we also know he's going to judge us according to our own works. And by the way, you're guilty, right? So there's no one that's going to intervene. There's going to be no special favors for any particular group of people. There's not going to be a special curve for people that have their name in the Embry Hills directory. There's not going to be a special dispensation or judgment for people that were members of this Christian family. You get it here? God is going to judge. He's going to judge without partiality. And Peter calls this out very directly. If you were a Jewish person reading this, this might come a little bit alarming to you as well. Basically, what he's saying here, the fact that you are Jewish isn't going to affect the judgment of God. He's going to judge without partiality. There's going to be no special favors, so you need to live your life accordingly. So there is an element of fear in that, and even in this impartial judgment. Second one, what's the other big, this is an important point, I don't want to skip it. What's the other big reason why there should be some fear about this judgment, and this judge in particular? This judge is kind of involved in the case a little bit, if you think about it, right? This judge that's judging you is the judge that gave you his son as a sacrifice. So this, we had a very high price paid for us through the blood of Christ. Without blemish, he was innocent, and he died for our sins. So when you're thinking about your life as a Christian in the context of God being this fair and impartial judge, then also thinking about what great sacrifice and great cost Christ and God went through for your salvation kind of really, really raises the stakes in terms of the importance of what we do in everything in our life. If it was something trivial, if it was the gold and silver that I think you guys talked about here, those things are perishable, those things are changeable. This is the most precious thing that God had. So in that context, all of these things, obedience, grace, hope, love, all the things we're going to talk about are super, super important. The stakes are very, very high based on this great salvation that God has given to us through his son. Okay. I think I had one more verse here about, well, we're going to skip it because we're out of time. Okay. Let's don't forget about love. So we talked a lot about grace. We've talked about obedience, being holy, putting aside former lust. Verse 22 of 1 Peter. Since you have, in obedience to the truth, been purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. Okay, so these are Christian people. This relationship with God is very, very important. Their own mental state, their own activities, their own obedience is very, very important. But love is also very, very important. And Christ demonstrated that in his own life as well. You can see over there in John chapter 13, this new commandment wasn't really a new command, but it was a new commandment in the fact that people hadn't really been following it, that we are to love each other. And by loving each other, it will be known that we are Christ's disciples. So this is an incredibly part of our spiritual life, and it really demonstrates a spiritual life. In John, 1 John chapter 3 and verse 14, we know that we have passed from death to life because we love the brethren. He who does not love his brother abides in death. So we talked about this transition out of sinful lust and changing your life where you're a new creation. You don't walk in those sinful ways as well anymore. Now Peter's saying, hey, you should be loving your brethren. And if you're not abiding in love with those that are around you, that is a proof of the fact that you are not really walking in this newness of life. You're just as dead as if you were living in sin. And then last but not least on this idea of love, it really demonstrates our relationship with God. For everyone that is born of God and knows God, everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. So it's demonstration of our love for God as well as we love our fellow man. So this is really, really important. It's important that he put it in here as well. These readers and us as well could think about all these things about something that's just focused on my relationship with God alone, but it's also based on my relationship with each other. Okay, I talked a lot on that. We didn't get as far as I'd like to. Any comments or questions before we introduce what I was supposed to get to today? I can't give Larry a hard time anymore for being over. But we will catch up. All right, so I'm going to introduce chapter 2. And I didn't really plan on doing too much with chapter 2, verses 1 through 10 anyway. So we're going to go at least start this. Now we have another therefore. That's where we're going to have to start on Wednesday night. Please, therefore, please at least read verses 1 through 10 and do lesson 4. Lesson 4, we're going to get into more about how we interact with each other, how we interact in a family setting, how we interact with government. More instruction there. Thank you.